From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and our moderator is Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Nationwide calls grow for police reform. Will Washington deliver? In Atlanta, two white officers are charged after another black man dies in police custody. Plus, a major victory for the LGBTQ community handed down by a conservative-leaning Supreme Court. And the latest on the coronavirus here in the U.S., where numbers are rising and what local officials are doing about it. Kimberly Adams, Molly Ball, excited to speak with both of you. Lots of news to cover. We could really choose any of those issues to start the show. But let's begin with police reform, since that's getting a lot of attention here in Washington this week. From the White House on down, of course, in the wake of the horrific killing of an African-American man, George Floyd, by a white officer last month in Minneapolis. Kimberly, let's start with you. This executive order signed by the president, what's in it, and does it go far enough for lawmakers?
I guess for the second part, it depends on which lawmakers you ask. Democrats are decidedly unimpressed. Republicans are saying it's a good first step. The Trump administration is basically saying that rather than sort of latch on with these defund the police movements or actually going to do a sort of top to bottom overhaul of policing in America, it's better to incentivize better behavior. That is, to incentivize de-escalation training, to incentivize police departments to track use of force, to track what they call sort of bad apples, the idea of making sure that individual police officers who maybe use force too much wouldn't be able to bounce around from one police department to another. Now, there are a couple of reasons that a lot of activists and a lot of Democrats think that this isn't enough. They say it does not go far enough in really targeting some of the systemic issues that occur with policing in America, that it doesn't address the inherent racial bias. It doesn't address things like what's called qualified immunity that allows police officers and other law enforcement to be exempt from a lot of civil suits and some legal proceedings. Additionally, many people are pointing out that the Trump administration has rolled back a lot of policing reform efforts that were put in place by the Obama administration. Sort of the last time this issue really flared up on the national stage after the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, very close to where I'm from in St. Louis. So there's not a lot of trust there on these issues. And a lot of people are saying this executive order does not go far enough.
Right. And as you mentioned, the problem with executive orders, as we've seen with the Obama executive order, is they can be rolled back by the next administration. But the president himself seemed to imply that Congress needs to do something. Molly, what are you hearing from lawmakers in both parties? Because both the Republicans and Democrats have their own ideas. What are the sticking points? What do they agree on? And most importantly, is either side willing to compromise to get something done?
Yeah, I mean, to me, what's really remarkable about this conversation is that there is some level of consensus that something needs to be done. That really tells you how far this conversation has moved. Really, just in the past month or so, we have seen skyrocketing levels of public support really across the board politically for the Black Lives Matter movement, for the protests, a more or less universal sort of moral repugnance at what happened to George Floyd and a feeling that something needs to be done. Now, of course, the devil's in the details. Of course, there is partisan disagreement, but it is really something that even, the Senate Republicans have introduced a measure that goes farther than this White House executive order. Now, part of that is just logistical, if you will, right? There's only so much that you can do with an executive order. Some things just require congressional action to get done. And the Republicans have said also that that's part of the reason that what they're introducing doesn't go as far as what the Democrats passed out of committee in the House last night, late Wednesday, but because the Republicans see less of a role for the federal government in an area of policing that is largely run at the state and local level. So the Republicans' bill does try to roll back the use of chokeholds, but it doesn't outright prohibit them as a matter of federal law, as the Democrats' legislation would do. The Republicans' bill does not engage with this issue of qualified immunity, which Democrats see as important. Both bills do, and the executive order, do look at creating some kind of database for use of force incidents. The executive order would only keep track of incidents where officers were disciplined, which critics say defeats the whole purpose of trying to increase discipline for out of control police. The Republican bill would collect data on some complaints, but not as much data as the Democrats would like. But there's long been this issue for police reformers, this frustrating inability to even get good information because so many police records either are not public or are not collated and tabulated at the state or federal level, just to keep track of who are these so-called bad apples, how many people and what circumstances are being assaulted or killed by police. So just having that information would be a huge step forward, even if, you know, even the Democrats' bill doesn't go nearly as far as some activists are calling for in the calls to defund police, dismantle police departments, and so on.
If I could just jump on that, this idea of sort of tracking the data, one of the reasons that a lot of activists are pointing to that being insufficient, as Molly was saying as one of the complaints, is there actually is an FBI use of force database for tracking the use of force by law enforcement in the United States. They started collecting data in January of 2019, and they were supposed to be releasing this data twice a year, but we don't have any data just yet. They say it's coming this summer. But as Molly points out, this is a locally controlled issue, and only about 40% of law enforcement officers in the United States are voluntarily contributing to this database. And so this is one set of data that there is an infrastructure for it, but it hasn't been particularly useful or meaningful just yet. And so this is probably playing into why collecting yet another set of data is considered to be, you know, not enough for many activists.
Right. It makes a lot of sense. You need the information so you're not having bad cops bounce around from place to place. It is remarkable, though, even though the Democrats and Republicans cannot agree, at least right now, on what police reform would look like, you are seeing a sea change in the Republican Party, Molly, as you pointed out, and it is backed by polls. Most Americans now believe that major police reform is needed. Even Lindsey Graham, on this issue of qualified immunity, which essentially means that police officers are shielded from lawsuits, even he, in a Senate judiciary hearing on police reform, he seemed to be open to discussions about possibly stripping that immunity because it would increase accountability for police officers. What do you make of that?
Well, it tells you how this public conversation has moved. I think the public awareness, not just police brutality itself, but the impunity of police officers and the role of police unions in all this, too, in keeping bad cops on the streets and insulating them from discipline, from consequences, and the relationships between local police and prosecutors, which also often act as a shield, as we saw in the case of Ahmaud Arbery before the George Floyd killing. So there's a lot of areas of potential agreement, but so often on Capitol Hill, those areas of potential agreement end up being less significant than the areas of disagreement and nothing gets done. So, you know, we're still in the early stages of this, but it really tells you a lot that, you know, in an election year, you know, Republicans and Democrats alike have seen the public's interest as mostly being on the side of so-called law and order, you know, wanting to get tougher and tougher and tougher on crime. And so it is really a change in the political valence of this discussion that even the Republicans who control the Senate in an election year, just a few months before an election, believe they have to act on this.
Yeah. And of course, as we've mentioned, all of this was sparked by what happened to George Floyd. It shocked the nation. We have seen protests all over, really, in big cities to small rural towns. Now, I went to visit Gettysburg a couple of days ago. It felt like the right moment. It's the site of one of the bloodiest battles in the Civil War. It's where Lincoln later gave his famous Gettysburg Address. This happened, of course, over 150 years ago, and a lot has changed in the country. But obviously, this battle for racial justice still very much continues, still is front and center. Kimberly, where are we seeing the protest movement for police reform sort of heading now in the wake of the George Floyd killing?
I think one of the key things that the protesters and the activists and advocates and allies, however you want to describe people, are working on at this point is keeping up momentum. Because as any Black person in America will tell you, we have been here before, where there is a sudden attention focused on racial injustice in this country, and then it just fades away and nothing really changes. So at least, you know, on the business and economic side, we're seeing a lot of pushing of corporate leadership and within workplaces to really address issues of pay equity, of lack of diversity in management, of microaggressions in workplaces and systemic racism in business and economics, and how our actual foundational systems in the United States, you know, are set up to disadvantage Black and brown people. So, for example, I did a story yesterday about how in tech and in coding language, they actually have language for servers that uses the terminology master server and slave server. And there's actually a movement within the tech. I kid you not. Our IT person flagged this for me, and I had the exact same reaction as you.
Yeah.
But the literal underpinnings of the tech industry, terms like whitelist and blacklist for, you know, safe emails versus malicious emails and servers. But in the sort of infrastructure of the internet, you have terminology like master and slave baked into it. And so as more and more people throughout the United States are really thinking deeply about these issues and what individual actions they can take to address systemic racism, you are seeing people like the IT person at my company coming up with what he can do to fix this. So he's working on changing our back-end code. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a note to the CEO of Cisco, which is a big networking firm, and said, what are you doing about this? And the CEO of Cisco says, we're working on it. LinkedIn, Microsoft, Google. There are a lot of these sort of movements in unexpected places where it's a surprise to many people that you find the evidence of systemic racism.
And now you're seeing the changes, as you're saying, or sort of a push for it. Let's pause here for the break. And as Kimberly just mentioned, we have been here before. There was another Black man dying in police custody, this time in Atlanta. Let's talk about it after the break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace. Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back. Kimberly, Molly, I want to touch on what's happening in Atlanta right now. Another Black man died in police custody there. The two officers involved are both white. This young Black man, his name is Rayshard Brooks. Prosecutors are now charging the two white officers involved. How is the city of Atlanta responding, Molly?
Well, there have been huge protests once again, in part because these incidents, you know, have achieved a level of visibility that they're going to promote protests, and in part because, as we've seen in so many of these cases, when we have video of these incidents, it becomes much more visceral to people. Now, that doesn't guarantee that something's going to be done, but it does make it a lot more vivid, more difficult for, you know, as we have learned, you know, law enforcement often doesn't tell the truth about these kinds of incidents, and that becomes much harder when there is video. And so the public awareness has led to things like prosecutions of officers, which have historically been vanishingly rare across the country. So again, you see the change in how these incidents are being handled. Of course, we still don't know what the result of that case is going to be, but definitely the increased focus on these issues and the protests have undeniably been effective in bringing national consciousness to these kinds of incidents and making sure that they can't be swept under the rug.
I want to sort of give an overview of the facts of this case. Obviously, we don't know everything yet, but it appears to be that Brooks was intoxicated. He fell asleep in his car at a Wendy's drive-thru. There was this long back and forth, but when police tried to arrest him, there was a fight. He stole one of the tasers from one of the officers, and while he was running away, he fired the taser at the officers. But he was shot in the back, and the DA says the killing wasn't justified because Brooks never presented a threat to these officers. Now there are reports of Atlanta police not showing up to work in support of these two officers. Kimberly, how are folks in Washington reacting to this particular story?
I think it's just factoring into the ongoing discussion that, as you mentioned earlier, something needs to be done. And some of that is just sort of the foundational way that we think of what the police should be doing. If someone is drunk and in a car, not driving, but sleeping, is it really the police that need to respond? What is the best way to detain that person? Or do they need to be sent home? And as many people have been pointing out, for what crimes is the sentence death? You know, is running away from a police officer? Is shooting a non-lethal weapon at a police officer? Does that equate to a death sentence? And in sort of reevaluating how we think about the role of police in America, I often bring up the fact that in order for a police officer to justify a use of force, they have to feel that they are at risk. And bringing it back to the systemic conversation about what America is and how we think about race in America, our entire society is kind of built up in media and in culture to perceive Black people, particularly Black men, as a threat. And so if your entire society is designed to view someone as threatening, it's pretty easy to understand why police officers might respond in that way. And I think all of those things are in the process of being questioned in terms of how we think about the next steps, whether it be at a local level, in terms of individual communities thinking about their own police departments, when it comes to how prosecutors are viewing these things, how federal legislators and lawmakers are thinking about it. But it's hard to take these individual incidents and say, this is what it means, as much as here is how this fits into the tapestry of this conversation that we're having as a country right now.
Right. And in this conversation, you're hearing from some Republican lawmakers who are pushing back against this idea of systemic racism. You know, they're attributing these actions to a few bad apples, as we've heard time and time again. But everyone seems to agree, as you guys both have pointed out, that there needs to be more training for police officers, especially in these situations, so that they don't use deadly force when it's not necessary. I want to briefly touch on another big story out of D.C. this week, a major victory for the LGBTQ community, handed down by the Supreme Court on Monday. The gay and trans people are now protected by law from discrimination at work. Molly, this is a conservative-leaning court. One of the conservative judges siding with the liberal judges here was Neil Gorsuch, a Trump appointee. How surprising is that?
Well, I think it depends where you're coming from. I think it was surprising to a lot of political actors, particularly political conservatives, who have seen Trump, even if they are occasionally frustrated by his public persona, seen Trump as a vehicle to enact their agenda through the courts. And so wanted, you know, Gorsuch to be sort of a warrior for conservative causes, including social conservatism. But, you know, legal scholars and people who follow such things would have told you before this opinion came out that Gorsuch is sort of a libertarian-leaning justice. He sees himself as a textualist. And that was abundantly clear in the oral arguments for this case when the litigants repeatedly appealed to that philosophy in order to try to win him over. It was very clear what they were doing. And, you know, in law, outcomes are not a matter of, or should not be necessarily just a matter of partisan politics, that they should be subject to judicial analysis. So it is relatively rare on the current court to see 6-3 decisions on major contentious partisan political issues. And you did see a lot of social conservatives sort of despairing because of that. But as a legal matter, this is not necessarily a result that surprised a lot of people. Well, it's a direction in which some lower courts had been moving for some time. But the outcome itself is, as you said, a major victory for the LGBTQ community, enshrining in, as a matter of legal precedent, something that they have been trying and failing to get through Congress for many, many years, a federal anti-discrimination law, which many states and localities have, but many still do not.
I'm not sure how many Americans studied the oral arguments in this matter as closely as you did, Molly. I think for a lot of conservatives who sort of held their nose and voted for Donald Trump in 2016 because they wanted to see more conservative judges on the court may actually be pretty surprised about this. And I'm wondering, in 2020, Kimberly, will the Supreme Court be front and center like we saw in 2016, now that you have one of Trump's own appointees sort of voting against what conservatives, their beliefs?
Wow, that's a tough one. It's hard to even imagine which of the various serious issues facing America are going to be front and center. We are still in a pandemic. The economy is in turmoil. We are in this very difficult discussion about race. And then there is also the Supreme Court, because we still do have quite a few justices who may be leaving the bench for one reason or another in the next term. You know, I just think about some of my friends back in St. Louis who don't like Trump, but care deeply around issues of abortion. And they will probably still support Trump over any Democratic candidate because that is their primary issue. And I think we saw that a lot the last time. I still think we're going to see that come 2020. And the question is, will that be offset by all of the people on the Democratic side who are mobilized against Trump and this sort of growing number of Republicans who are just so disenchanted with him that they can't think about voting for him again?
I want to jump in to say, I think that's a really important point, that over the course of Trump's term, we have seen progressives become very activated by the issue of Supreme Court appointments, particularly after that pitched partisan battle over the Kavanaugh nomination. I think it used to be that it was primarily conservatives, particularly social conservatives, who were activated, motivated to vote by the issue of Supreme Court appointments. But now we see a lot of progressives joining as well. At the same time, this issue of LGBT non-discrimination is something that has widespread bipartisan support among the public. It's a relatively small number of, you can't say all Republicans or even all conservatives or even all religious conservatives oppose the idea of this type of non-discrimination. So there are certainly some on the religious right who believe strongly that this should not be the case, but it's not broadly the view of even all Republicans.
That's a very good point, Molly. And as to Kimberly's point, when it comes to abortion, that's an issue that may bring out more Republican voters in the end. Kimberly, you mentioned the pandemic. Of course, that is still very much an issue. It has not gone away, despite the attention on other stories, despite states reopening. As we are talking, nearly 120,000 Americans have died. Some states, the numbers are falling, like in the Northeast and New York, but we are seeing surging numbers in other states, like in Florida and Texas. And there seems to be this debate where you have some Republicans saying it's because of increased testing that we're seeing numbers come up. And then you have public health experts pushing back on that idea. Can you play out that debate for us, Kimberly?
Right. So one of the big pushes throughout this pandemic has been, we need more testing. We need to know who is sick or who has been in contact with the virus, in addition to building up the public health infrastructure to deal with the people who are very sick. Now, we have increased testing across the country. And so some of the, you know, spike in cases that we're seeing is attributable to the fact that we're just testing more people. That was always going to happen. But the point that many health officials are making, which you kind of got to, is that that doesn't eliminate the sort of rate of overall portion of the population that now has the virus, or the rate of hospitalizations, the people who are so sick that they have to go to the hospital. When you talk about these reopenings, the economy has taken such a hit. So many people are out of work. The country is basically being asked to decide how much of an economic hit we are willing to take in exchange for people's lives. Now, of course, those illnesses and deaths are falling predominantly on lower income people, people of color, particularly Hispanics and Black Americans. And so that plays into everything. I mean, I was speaking with someone last night, Black woman who has lost 7 people in her family to COVID-19. Her husband has lost 3 people, and a couple more people are sick. So this is still a very real and emotional thing for many people. But in the places where they haven't seen already at this point these high number of deaths, like you have in places like New York, what they are feeling the most is not having a job, of having maybe to go to a food bank for the first time in their life. And of not knowing how they're going to pay their bills. And that is its own kind of trauma. And all of these things are informing people's response.
All right, that is all the time we have. Thank you, Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. This program is produced by The Voice of America. I'm Shanna Stulen. Thanks for listening.